Morning, everybody. We're going to go ahead and begin the hearing on the interconnection agreements between Altel and McCook, Kennebec, Santel, and West River telephone companies. It's approximately 9:30 in the morning on August 3rd, and we are here in room 414 at State Capitol. This is the time and place that was noticed for this hearing. I'm Dusty Johnson, Commission Chairman, and Commissioner Steve Kolbeck and Gary Hansen are also present. I'll be presiding over this hearing. The issue to be determined by the Commission is what is the appropriate reciprocal compensation rate for intra-MTA traffic. All parties have the right to be present and to be represented by an attorney. All persons testifying will be sworn in and subject to cross-examination by the parties. The Commission's final decision may be appealed by the parties to the State Circuit Court and the State Supreme Court. We do have a court reporter, so please make sure to speak slowly and clearly and into your microphone. Just a reminder, we are broadcasting on the Internet, and this will be archived. Roland Weiss, the Commission's counsel, will act as hearing examiner and will conduct the hearing subject to the Commission's oversight. She may provide recommended rulings on procedural and evidentiary matters. The Commission may overrule its counsel's preliminary rulings throughout the hearing. If not overruled, the preliminary rulings will become final rulings. And at this time, unless there's any objection from my colleagues, we will turn the hearing over to Ms. Weiss. Ms. Weiss, proceed.
Thank you. First, we'll take appearances of the parties. Petitioners?
Excuse me. Good morning, Commissioners, Commission staff. Meredith Moore, appearing on behalf of Kennebec Telephone Company, McCook Cooperative Telephone Company, Santel Communications Cooperative, and West River Cooperative Telephone Company this morning. Thank you.
Altel?
Talbot Wysorek of Gunderson, Palmer, Nelson, and Ashmore for Altel today.
Staff?
Karen Kramer with Commission staff.
Okay, thank you. Before we get started with testimony, are there any motions or other matters that we should hear first?
Ms. Weiss, I did file a request that the Commission just accept some of what I thought were admitted facts into the record. Last week, I noticed that Friday afternoon there was an objection filed. And I don't know if you want to deal with that as part of the preliminary matter or if you want to deal with that after we get into evidence.
I think we could. Well, do you have a preference?
I'm open to whatever your preference would be. Since we're talking about, maybe I should just address what I've attempted to do there and my opinion on it, if that's would be acceptable.
Go ahead.
Last Monday, I filed what I perceived as admissions that were made in discovery by the RLX. The objections, as I understand them, that were filed by the petitioner's counsel were that, well, I asked those as data requests, and I didn't ask them as requests for admissions. You know, and from a technical standpoint, that might be true. However, I find it difficult to accept the argument that somebody can be asked in a data request, admit the following is true, and that they admit it or deny it, and then claim that that can't, for some reason, be submitted for the purposes of the record. The reason I laid all that out, the reason I suggested that we just file those so they're on record is to avoid the need for me to walk up and show my discovery to a witness, have the witness read it into the record, which I could do with the discovery anyway. I wasn't, as the commission, if they had, in looking at the motion, I added all the objections. Essentially the objections were made to every data request. I'm open to the commission. I think the commission can accept them, given the way the answers were given. Allow me just to mark that for the purposes of the record, or say we're going to accept Exhibit A for the purposes of the record as filed for the motion, or the commission can say no, cross-examine on every one of them. And I'm acceptable either way. The cross-examination might add some time. But like I said, I didn't put in any interrogatories that said explain for me or do any of this. It was all admit this or that. I, quite frankly, had a witness who asked me, a corporate person asked me, well, can't you throw in a bunch of interrogatories? I said, well, I think unless I ask for him to admit, I don't think that's appropriate. Then I can cross him on it. So I limited my submissions to those. And again, why I, Ms. Moore has a technical argument. Ms. Moore is an accomplished attorney, and when I'm asking in a data request, admit the following, I think it's kind of it becomes a distinction without a difference to now say, well, that really wasn't a request for admission.
Ms. Moore.
Thank you. Mr. Wazorek's comments are well taken. The initial argument that I did make in opposition to the motion to admit these particular facts as admitted facts is that the purpose of a request for admission is to narrow the scope of the issues at trial. And it's also to show that something has been conclusively established as a fact that doesn't need any further elaboration or explanation, or that may not be subject to clarification or objection, whether it be through a party's witness or a party's counsel, for that matter. So these particular responses can certainly be used by Mr. Wazorek when cross-examining the witnesses, and I would submit to the commission that that is the appropriate manner in which they should be used. And that's also the manner in which they should be used that the law contemplates. So from the standpoint of admitting a particular response as a conclusively established fact, when the petitioners have objected to and qualified the response to a certain extent, what happens there is that you take the admission, as Mr. Wazorek has couched it, out of context. You don't allow the parties to appropriately explain it, and you run the risk of having an issue either misidentified, misunderstood, or simply standing alone in the record without the proper explanatory testimony or the appropriate give and take, whether it be between Mr. Wazorek and his witness, Mr. Wazorek and the petitioner's witnesses, or myself and the witnesses. And in this particular case, the purported admissions that Mr. Wazorek seeks to admit as an exhibit themselves deal with the issue of capacity, which is one of the prime issues before this commission, of course, today, given the commission's directive that was issued in February of 2009. And so what we're talking about there are the OC3s, the OC12s, the OC48s, and the OC192s. Those are issues that were addressed last time and will certainly be in dispute again here today. And to simply introduce as a standalone exhibit and admit a purported admission that we would submit has not been conclusively established isn't the appropriate use. We have no objection to Mr. Wazorek getting to use that information on direct, on cross, or in other means, and that's the way it should come in. So it's not necessarily the substance of the response. However, it is the procedure by which he seeks to admit it to which we object. Thank you.
Ms. Kramer.
Thank you. From staff's perspective, this is the petitioner's objection does appear to be form over substance, I believe. And I believe the commission could grant Altel's motion and then allow the petitioners to, you know, fill in the facts to ensure a complete record. Or the commission could deny the motion and allow the same facts to come in through the questioning of witnesses. Either way, it's going to take a long time, I believe. And so I'm not sure you're going to gain anything in terms of time management one way or the other. So staff's recommendation would be, in an overabundance of caution here, I would deny the motion and have them have Mr. Wazorek put in the testimony on these issues through direct or cross or however he needs to do that to complete the record.
Given that they weren't entitled as requests for admissions and that, you know, reading through the answers, it doesn't appear that petitioners necessarily perceive them as requests for admissions. For example, some of them didn't really say admitted or denied, but tried to further explain or qualify their answer. I think I would agree with staff that out of abundance of caution, we'll deny the motion, and ALTAL can seek to provide this information through the testimony. Thank you. Are there any other motions?
Excuse me, Ms. Weiss. Is this just a data? Was this just data request?
It was part.
Is it argumentative? Is there?
They vary. I mean, some of them are. They're part of data requests or interrogatories.
If it's on the face, if it's just data, I don't see how it would prejudice the process here to admit it. I'm just curious what.
The problem as I see it is that in the response to many of these, when you're dealing with discovery, you can respond to it, but it's not necessarily admissible evidence. And the petitioners did object to a number of these, and essentially saying, well, we'll answer this, but we don't think it's actually admissible evidence.
Okay.
And so that's why I would think that Mr. Vazori can certainly attempt to get it in, but Ms. Moore can also object to it on
all
that
right.
basis.
Thank you.
Anything else?
I have nothing.
Did the parties want to go through exhibits that you marked, or we'll just do it as witnesses are called?
My thought would be to do it as witnesses are called, if that suits the commission.
That's fine. Did any of the parties wish to make any opening statements? Ms. Moore?
I would simply make a preliminary statement this morning. Obviously, the commission has directed the petitioners in this case to revise the FLEX studies that were previously presented to you, and you set out guidelines in those findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order that were issued on February 28th of 2009. The petitioners have presented testimony from Nathan Weber, who will be testifying in regard to the engineering issues, the inputs, and the proposed FLEC networks. Mr. Tim Eklund will be testifying in regard to the revisions done to the FLEC model and what will be presented here to you today. Thank you.
Mr. Vazori?
Just as a preliminary, I agree that the Commission set forth various obligations in its findings and conclusions. And as was noted at the beginning of the hearing, these all revolve around the reciprocomp question. And we're going to have Mr. Conwell try to testify to a number of those issues. There's been some difficulty in getting everything in the record simply because it's. I think as the hearing progresses, the commission understand that the transport issue was essentially ignored in the first round of testimony by the petitioners, which forced us to get very expansive in our testimony and say, you know, these issues are being ignored. And the commission asked, as I understood it, asked the petitioners to come in and that they could not justify the OC-192 network given the demand. And what the testimony shows to date, and which I think will become obvious here, is they're actually forecasting demand now lower than they did last year, but still have the same size network. What also become obvious in a way then to end round it is they waited till their second round of testimony then to say, well, maybe an OC-48, maybe that's a cost structure that could be used. I would tell you, even with an OC-48, their demand doesn't even justify that. I believe the evidence is going to show that. And that they only downsized certain parts of that network when they did that analysis. This becomes difficult because it becomes highly technical, look behind all the issues. And I appreciate the commission giving us a chance to lay some of these issues out, and there will be some examination on some of these capacity issues that I think will make clear that we're not much further along in the FLEX study than we were a year ago. Thank you.
Ms. Kramer?
Thank you. Staff has nothing.
Okay. Ms. Moore, you may call your first witness.
Thank you. The petitioners call Nathan Weber. Mr. Weber, would you please state your full name for the record, your employer, and the purpose of your testimony here today?
My name is... My name is Nathan Weber. I am currently employed by Vantage Point Solutions as the Director of Engineering. And I previously provided testimony in this case, both pre-filed and live, for this arbitration proceeding. The purpose of my testimony today is to provide and explain the technical facts with regard to the revisions made to the petitioner's flex studies. Following this commission's oral ruling on January 29, 2009, it issued its findings of fact, conclusions of law, and an order in February of 2009, which directed the petitioners to do the following. One, recalculate the transport rate using the rate equivalency method rather than the path method or the bandwidth method previously proposed by the parties. Number two, to remove the costs associated with Centrex, Kalea, and Web Self-Care from the switching costs originally used in the flex study. And three, to forecast the future demand for transport and recalculate the transport rate using that updated demand.
Mr. Weber, on which of the commission's directives did you provide testimony?
I provided technical facts in regards to the Commission's second directive, the removal of the costs associated with the Centrex, Kalea, and Web Self-Care components of the switching network. I developed revised cost estimates for the proposed switching network for each of the RLECs identified in this proceeding, and similar to the cost estimates used in the original FLEC design, I based that off of a network utilizing pricing received from a company called MetaSwitch, using pricing received on competitive proposals for other RLECs with similar size and scope and needs as the four in this proceeding. Based on the revisions to the removal for the Kalea, the Centrex, and the Web Self-Care, we came up with new cost estimates for the CO switch detail. And those cost estimates were provided in exhibits NW-S-1.
And at this time, I will offer to the commission that we do have additional copies of the exhibits that were attached to Mr. Weber's testimony for handouts if anyone would like those, because he does intend to talk about those briefly.
And if I could clarify, that was exhibits NW-S-1 through NW-S-4 for the four respective companies. Now, I will talk briefly about those cost estimates, and I believe that to be confidential information.
That is correct.
Okay, with that, we will go off the web.
A podcast of SDPB's online coverage is available at sdpb.org/statehouse.
Go back on the web. Go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Weber, in this case, have you had an opportunity to review Craig Conwell's testimony that's been filed by Altel?
Yes, I have.
And Mr. Conwell has specifically commented on your testimony. Do you disagree with any of Mr. Conwell's criticisms of your testimony?
I do have, three primary disagreements with Mr. Conwell, not only with my testimony, but other statements he made that on the periphery of my testimony. Specifically, the first item was with regards to a statement he makes indicating that the cost of providing a special access DSO circuit is much greater than a switched access DS0 circuit. In other words, a voice trunk. He made a number of statements regarding the cost in his testimony, but in reviewing his testimony, I was unable to find any exhibits, any technical information, any pricing detail to really substantiate his assertions. I don't believe his comments are really accurate with the way things occur in this industry. As indicated in his rebuttal testimony, Mr. Conwell argues that there's some circuit conditioning and multiplexing equipment used to multiplex and multiplex DS0 special circuits. He indicates as well that DS0 voice circuits are multiplexed in the switch itself, so therefore there is no external circuit conditioning equipment required. And that's the basis on which he argues that the voice services cost less than special access services. I don't believe this to be, a factually correct scenario. I don't believe it to be founded. And to illustrate this, I provided an exhibit, NW-R2-1. With regards to this example, what I showed for illustrative purposes is a scenario in which we have multiple different types of traffic traveling in on a single DS1. In this example, we assume that there's a certain quantity of DS0s within that DS1 that are carrying toll traffic, a certain number that are carrying services such as operator circuits, and then a number of special access circuits. The circuit conditioning equipment used in this example is referred to as a channel bank. And essentially the functionality of a channel bank is to take a DS1 in and break it down into 24, or up to 24 individual DS0 physical interfaces. And in this example, we show that those special circuits, in this example, 8 special circuits, would then be taken from that channel bank and connected into some subscriber access equipment, whatever is being used to deliver that special circuit to the end customer. In addition, any of the traffic that's destined for the switch in this generic example would then be multiplexed back into a DS1 via a second channel bank. Now, one other thing that, you know, Mr. Conwell contended was that, you know, this is a very specific example and is not indicative of every single DS1 that comes into, you know, the network, that there are some DS1s that only contain voice trunks. He uses McCook as an example. With McCook, if you recall from the Flex study, the switch in McCook's case only had DS3 interfaces into it. So what's not shown in this particular exhibit is another piece of circuit conditioning equipment would be required. What I'll refer to as an M13 multiplexer. That's a device that takes up to 28 DS1s and combines them onto a DS3 interface. That DS3 interface would then ultimately connect into the switch. So with that scenario in mind, even if we had DS1 interfaces coming off the transport that only contained, you know, voice-grade services, DS0 voice services that terminate at the switch, we still have external circuit conditioning equipment in the form of an M13 multiplexer that's required to get it to a DS3 interface to input into the switch. So
required to get it to a DS3 interface or what?
The interface to terminate the switch. So really, ultimately, what I'm trying to do is not get muddied up in all the technical details, but to show that regardless of what the circuit types are, there's likely the need for external multiplexing equipment, and to arbitrarily draw a conclusion that DSO special circuits are somehow drastically more expensive than DS0 voice circuits, to me, is unfounded.
Mr. Weber, are there other areas of Mr. Conwell's testimony that you disagree with?
There are, and I know that one of the points of contention in this is the use of an OC-192, and there's been a lot of discussion regarding utilization of an OC-192. One thing that I did want to point out to the commission is the fact that when we talk about SONET networks, you know, we have a growth from one size of network to another in an increment of 4 times the previous bandwidth. In other words, an OC-192 is 4 times the capacity of an OC-48. And they would like you to consider the fact that, you know, an OC-192 is an immense amount of bandwidth, but the key is an OC-192 really becomes necessary if at any point, any one snapshot in time, the bandwidth requirement on the network exceeds the OC-48 by just merely a single DS0. So in other words, if the network becomes 25.0, if the OC-192 network becomes 25.0001% utilized, then an OC-192 is necessary. There is no increment between an OC-48 and an OC-192. And the key there that I want to state is that would be for any snapshot in time. If there is a need or a situation where momentarily the bandwidth requirements that need to be transported exceeds an OC-48, as an example, if we have a traffic cut over the network where we're transitioning from one type of access equipment to another, we have to have both systems up in parallel. So in other words, we have to transport the bandwidth twice, effectively, for a very brief period of time. And that, you know, may cause the bandwidth requirements to exceed an OC-48. While, you know, it may not be shown on a forecast, it may be a practical implementation why an OC-48 is not sufficient. Another point that I want to make with regards to OC-192 is if we want to look at real-life scenarios, you know, what do these companies have in place? You know, if we look at where these four petitioners are today, West River currently has an OC-192 in place. You know, Santel currently has a network equivalent to an OC-192 in place. Kennebec currently has a node in their network that resides in an OC-192 ring. McCook is currently in the planning phases of implementing a new transport network that would have the equivalent capacity to an OC-192. So we're not talking about blue sky things here that these companies will never implement. This is real. This is what they're doing. In addition, if you look at the networks that I have engineered over the past 9 years, especially the ones since 2005, as I've testified previously, over 90% of those networks have gone in at an OC192 or equivalent since 2005. So this is what's real. This is forward-looking. This is what companies are doing.
Mr. Weber, one of Mr. Conwell's additional arguments is that in this case, the petitioners should have used 24 fiber cable as opposed to 48. Do you have any comments in regard to that issue?
Yes, and I provided rebuttal testimony to this particular example as well. And, specific to the size of the fiber optic cable, when we take a look at placing cable in the ground, just for general rules of thumb, you can make the assumption that approximately 70% of the cost with putting a fiber optic cable in the ground is just the labor itself, the cost for opening up the ground and putting the cable in. The remaining 30% is really the materials, the cable, so that's really what's affected by, going from a 48 fiber to a 24 fiber. When you break that 30% down further, typically speaking, about 65% of that cost is associated with the outer jacket of the cable, the sheath. It has nothing to do with how many, fiber strands are in there. The remaining 35% is typically what's associated with the, the number of fibers inside that sheath. So what we really get down to is when you look at things as a whole, relatively low percentages of costs are influenced by changing from a 48 fiber to a 24 fiber. In fact, I believe Mr. Conwell has an exhibit where he shows the price reduction for that, he shows that moving from a 48 fiber to a 24 fiber for Santel would be approximately a 7.3% reduction in the cost of the outside plant cable construction for Santel, and on the high range for West River it would be a 9.6% reduction in cost. The reason why I feel this is negligible really, pertains to the fact that outside plant cable construction increases every year. There's an inflationary factor there. As I had previously testified in approximately a year ago, outside plant cable construction typically increases by a factor of approximately 5 to 10% per year. In the normalizing effect that we used to come up with our per mile rate for rural construction, we used a 5% normalizing factor to bring them up to 2007 numbers. So if you really put this in context, for 2009 today, you look at 5% increases over the last 2 years, the construction of a 24 fiber cable today likely costs more than the construction of a 48 fiber cable 2 years ago when this flex study was originally done. So to me, it's just really a matter of splitting hairs at that point in time.
And Mr. Weber, what do you consider to be standard engineering practice when it comes to the type of fiber utilized in a network?
When we are looking at, specifically fiber that's used to connect between exchanges, so inter-exchange fiber transport, the standard size that we typically use in our engineering designs is 48 fiber cable. And that's really due to the fact that the incremental cost to go from, another standard size of fiber like 24 to 48 is very negligible.
What was your goal in designing the proposed FLEC networks that have been shown in the FLEC study and which have been provided to the commission in this case?
Really, ultimately, it comes down to the definition of FLEC, and that's a forward-looking economic cost. We designed this network based on how this would truly be built if we were starting and designing this network today. Doing things like undersizing the fiber optic transport electronics, undersizing the fiber optic cable itself, tends to cause increased cost long run because you end up going back and doing that work again. To go through and have to construct additional fiber because you were short-sighted and undersized it costs the company money in the long run. Same thing with the transport. If you undersize the transport and have to not only make, a certain investment and before the depreciable life of the equipment have to increase that investment because you're short-sighted, that also costs more money and increases the total life cycle cost of that equipment.
In these particular cases, do you believe you've designed an appropriate network to be utilized in the Flex study that was based upon these companies' needs?
Yes, I do.
Is there anything else that we have not covered in regard to either your supplemental or your rebuttal testimony that you'd like to comment on?
Not at this time.
The petitioners would then move for the introduction of Exhibit 78, which is Mr. Weber's pre-filed supplemental testimony, including exhibits. This is a confidential document, and we would also move for the introduction of Exhibit 79, which is the pre-filed rebuttal testimony of Nathan Weber, including the exhibits originally filed with that testimony. That is also a confidential document.
Ms. Moore, I have a problem with this whole thing going in as confidential. I think last time when you filed everything as confidential, but then I believe most of the written portions of the testimony did not go in as confidential. My problem is that, you know, obviously his name and who he's testifying on behalf is not confidential.
Certainly, Ms. Weiss, the only problem with, I would say, the second exhibit, which would be Exhibit 79, that references specific numbers in and out of the testimony, so I don't believe that can be broken down as easily. If the commission would like, I can introduce the exhibits separately from the testimony in regard to the pre-filed supplemental testimony, which could then go in not as confidential, but the exhibits would need to be confidential because they are dealing with the specific pricing information for the various component parts of the switch.
But except if you're saying the pre-filed, even the pre-filed rebuttal, I don't see that as all confidential. I mean, didn't he just talk about everything that's on page 3?
He did. If you would like, I can prepare an additional exhibit that would not have that. It's just a question of how we would break that out.
Right. What I would like you to do, and I don't know if you need to do this now or if we can wait to do it on a break or something, but what I would like is from you is specific line numbers that you want to remain confidential in Exhibit 79 that are actually confidential.
I can do that. I can provide that at a break if that's appropriate.
Is that okay with you, Mr. Wazori, or would you like her to do it now?
Providing that at a break is fine.
Okay, so then with respect to Exhibit 78, which is the supplemental testimony of Mr. Weber, do you want the exhibits marked separately, or do you just want that portion to remain confidential?
I would like that portion to remain confidential, please.
Okay, so the written testimony in pages 1 through 3, there are some numbers on page 3.
We would ask that lines 7 through 10 be treated as confidential on page 3.
Okay, so the written testimony of the supplemental, excluding lines 7 through 10 on page 3, is not confidential. The attached exhibits are confidential. Just dealing with that exhibit alone, are there any objections to that testimony and those exhibits coming in?
Ms. Weiss, may I ask a question?
Go ahead.
Whether Ms. Moore filed a public version of this testimony?
No, she did not.
No. Okay, well, then that answers that. I have no objection to the exhibits coming in. I would ask, rather than even trying to do it at a break, maybe mm-hmm. what she should do is file a public version of these exhibits. I'll tell you quite frankly, I only brought my confidential where it's all marked confidential, where I highlighted to mark tomorrow. As I recall, that's how we did it last year, that the public version was on file already that people could refer to. So I had planned only marking my confidential highlighted versions how I do it.
Right.
But it would seem to make more sense to have a public version filed rather than trying to have her do a quick highlight during the break. And then that way you know the public version that's on file. It's just my suggestion. And it would be easier for me in doing my brief than trying to look back through the record and figure out what's not public and what is.
Would you object to that, Ms. Moore?
No, we would not.
Okay, so Exhibit 78 has been offered, and I will admit it. And with the provision that a public version will be submitted, and then with Exhibit 79, are there any objections to that testimony?
I would just ask that a public version be filed for ease of reference.
Any objection, Ms. Moore?
No, the petitioners will do so.
Thank you. And so that Exhibit 79 has been offered and received. Thank you.
We would tender this witness for cross-examination.
Mr. Wazorek.
Mr. Weber, my name is Talbot Wazorek. I have some questions on behalf of Altel. First, just some general questions. I want to make sure that we're all understanding some of the general aspects here. You talked about the some of these companies already rolled out OC192 networks, correct?
That is correct.
So what do you consider efficient utilization of a transport as it like approaches the end of service of life?
As I stated previously, you know, in order to justify a transport network such as an OC-192, you know, at any point in time during the course of its usable life, as long as it exceeds the capacity of a lesser network such as an OC-48, then it's justified.
Okay, so as long as there's it at, during its life, it exceeds 25% utilization.
At any given point in time, correct.
Okay. You would agree with me this that switch traffic is trending down.
Excuse me, is what?
Trending down. I'm sorry. I only have so much cord.
Yes.
I'll try. Okay, I'm sorry.
You know, I believe Mr. Eklund has forecasted switch traffic. You know, in general, for RLX, it is trending down. I can't speak specifically to his trend.
All right. Well, you don't object to Mr. Eklund's statement that it's trending down.
If you made that statement, I would not object to it.
Okay. So you're not telling this commission that voice traffic, voice switch traffic, is what's going to drive this over an OC48, are you?
I made no statement to that, no.
Yeah, I know. That's why I'm just trying to clarify. The voice traffic, especially the switch voice traffic, isn't driving the need for these networks.
Yeah, obviously, the need for these networks is to serve a variety of services, and the design was based on, you know, a single network to provide all those services.
But the services that are creating the demand are video, packet data, and those types of things. Correct?
Those are some of the services that would be put on the transport network, correct?
Well, we talked about switch traffic. We talked about that. What else is creating the demand if it's not switch traffic?
With regards to, you know, this network, obviously, you know, there's a variety of multimedia services that would be carried over that. If you want me to talk specifically about these four companies and what was forecast for demand, that wasn't part of my responsibility in these proceedings. You can ask Mr. Eklund that question.
Well, I'm going to ask you some questions about that because you had to design an efficient network, correct? That you understood that as your task?
Correct.
And you would agree that if a network would only use 2% of the capacity during the forecasted life, that's not efficient utilization?
I would agree with that.
Okay. How about 10% of a OC-192? If they would never exceed 10%, would that be efficient utilization?
A 10% usage would obviously be something that would be less than the requirements for an OC-192.
Well, it would be inefficient.
If you say so.
Well, I'm asking you. You would agree it would be inefficient.
If it was only 10% utilized, a lesser network could be used.
Okay. How about 25%?
If it's at exactly 25%?
Right.
If it's at exactly 25%, that would be the maximum threshold of an OC48. Therefore, a company would be prevented from having the ability to turn up any additional services, and not having the ability to offer a service to a consumer, I think, would be a bad practice.
All right. Now, I want to drop back a little bit and talk about how you design your efficient network. When you calculated the efficient network, you figured for every 5 end users, 1 voice trunk, if I recall your testimony correct?
From a previous testimony, yes, that is correct.
Yeah, and I'm going to, because I can't really deal with the issues that you're talking about today without talking about some of your previous testimony, so I feel free to make those clarifications, but understand that some of your previous testimony is going to intertwine here, okay?
Understood.
And then that voice traffic from your end users comes into the switch at analog and is converted by the switch that you've forecasted here, correct?
The traffic coming into the switch, you know, would be coming into the switch as, you know, as an analog, you know, voice trunk.
Okay. The switch converts it to digital, correct?
It would be a digital signal there, yes.
And then, as I understand your testimony, because we talked about ports and on the switch then only has DS1 connections for switch voice traffic, isn't that correct, to get onto the transport network?
The FLEC engineering model that was used assumed meta-switch for the switching network. Depending on the particular location, it either would have a DS1 level you know, digital signal for interfacing, or a DS3 level circuit for interfacing.
All right. There's no to put voice traffic, switch voice traffic, onto your transport network, there's no DSO connections to the switch.
When you look at the soft switch model that was assumed for this FLEC engineering model, they do not have any analog line cards in the soft switch, no.
So the answer is that's correct. There's no DSO connections.
There are no DS0 analog line cards.
I'm sorry. I try to catch myself. It's a DS0, not DSO, but I mean the same thing, all right? So when in your transport analysis, what you did was you calculated how many voice trunks are necessary, and then you divided that by 24 to figure out how many DS1s would be necessary in the transport network to handle switch voice traffic, didn't you?
That is correct.
The so by the time this anything coming off the switch is at a DS1 level or higher.
That is correct.
And that's because the switch upsizes that to a DS1 level because that's more efficient than trying to have hundreds of DSO connections, or DS0s, excuse me. Wouldn't you agree?
It's due to the fact that the switch just basically doesn't have an analog, you know, line interface into it. Any trunk would be combined onto a DS1 or a DS3 interface.
And you agree for that's more efficient to do it at the DS1 level than the DS0 level, don't you?
I guess it's not really a question of efficiency. It's a question of what's available on the switch. I mean, I can't speak to exactly why the switch manufacturer designed their switch a certain way.
Well, but you're testifying here as an engineer. Are you telling this commission it'd be more efficient to actually separately attach every voice trunk to the switch?
I didn't say that.
Okay.
I just said I can't speak specifically to the reason why a switch manufacturer designs their equipment a certain manner.
And I'm not asking you to presuppose or guess why somebody did it. I'm just asking as an engineer, it's more efficient to do it at the DS1 level than the DSO, wouldn't you agree?
The interfaces have been done on a DS1 level, and you know, that's because that's how it's done in the industry.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to approach. Do you want me to ask every time before I approach? Or?
No.
Please. I'm going to be walking up there a lot.
to provide you a copy today. And this is a copy of the discovery responses. Do you want more for the record? Do you want to show the witness? Do you not have copies for everybody that's only going to ask specific questions?
That would be up to you whether you want it marked or not.
Why don't we go ahead and mark it? We'll seek to admit it, but then it would be in the record for
I know. You know, be up there. Could you go back? Just use the mic when you're done.
I will.
Thank you.
It's been marked just for reference purposes as all until 17. And the question I'm going to have on this is confidential.
Okay.
So we can go off the record. It is the, or more, as it's the response from June 22nd of this year.
Okay. And so we will go off the web at this point, Mr. Azari?
Yes, please.
Okay, we'll go off the web for confidential information.
Okay. Now,
so we're back on. So if any, you think it's any confidential in this more, just interrupt, okay?
Thank you.
So, and I just want to get some benchmarks here so I know what we're talking about and make sure that I'm doing my math correct. But I calculate an OC3 is essentially 1/64th of the capacity of an OC192.
That is correct.
Okay. And so essentially an OC3 is, if an OC3 is then sufficient to carry all traffic, over the life of the transport system, it's not efficient, you would agree, I think you agreed earlier, to use an OC192 to do the job.
Can you rephrase the question, please, Mr. Wazorek? Did you indicate all traffic or did you indicate switched traffic?
I believe I said all traffic, meaning, and I'll try to make that clarification. And if you don't understand which traffic I'm talking about, but let's talk about all traffic. Yeah. So if an OC3 is sufficient to carry all traffic over the lifetime of the equipment, then it's inefficient to use an OC192, correct?
If an OC3 is sufficient, you know, to carry the traffic, then an OC192 may not be warranted.
Okay. Now, I am going to ask you, you've reviewed Mr. Eklund's testimony, is that correct?
I have not reviewed Mr. Eklund's testimony.
Okay. Well, Mr. Eklund's going to be putting some exhibits in the record, so you haven't looked at his exhibits or his tables or anything on his forecasted demand. Am I to understand that?
That is correct.
Okay. Well, and I'm just going to lay out some ground rules, and I'm going to represent to you what he's got in his testimony, and we'll figure it out with him and get it all in the record. So kind of assume these as hypotheticals, all right? If you have in your demand the requirements of a DS3, how much capacity is that?
A DS3 is equivalent to 28 DS1 circuits.
So how many DS1s in an OC3?
An OC3 is equivalent to 3 DS3s, which therefore would be equivalent to 84 DS1s.
All right, so if the most demand ever forecasted for our system for all traffic is only 64 DS1s, a DS3 is sufficient to carry all that traffic, correct?
No.
Why is that?
Because a DS3 is only 28 DS1s.
I'm sorry, an OC3. But an OC3 would be sufficient for 64 DS1s.
If we had 64 DS1s in the network, and that was all we were transporting, then an OC3 with 84 DS1 capacity would be sufficient.
Okay. Let's, Ms. Wiest, I'm going to mark these exhibits. They contain confidential information, but I think I can ask questions in a way that the questions won't be confidential. Commissions, this is Exhibit 14 also. Or excuse me, Exhibit 13. Do all these at the same time, so it's, so I don't have to walk up your argument. Yeah, you can do all your stretching. Now,
so we're back on. So if any, you think it's any confidential, Ms. Moore, just interrupt, okay?
Thank you.
So, and I just want to get some benchmarks here so I know what we're talking about and make sure that I'm doing my math correct. But I calculate an OC3 is essentially 1/64th of the capacity of an OC192.
That is correct.
Okay. And so essentially an OC3 is, if an OC3 is then sufficient to carry all traffic, over the life of the transport system, it's not efficient, you would agree, I think you agreed earlier, to use an OC192 to do the job.
Can you rephrase the question, please, Mr. Wazorek? Did you indicate all traffic or did you indicate switched traffic?
I believe I said all traffic, meaning, and I'll try to make that clarification. And if you don't understand which traffic I'm talking about, but let's talk about all traffic.
Okay.
So if an OC3 is sufficient to carry all traffic over the lifetime of the equipment, then it's inefficient to use an OC192, correct?
If an OC3 is sufficient, you know, to carry the traffic, then an OC192 may not be warranted.
Okay. Now, I am going to ask you, you've reviewed Mr. Eklund's testimony, is that correct?
I have not reviewed Mr. Eklund's testimony.
Okay. Well, Mr. Eklund's going to be putting some exhibits in the record, so you haven't looked at his exhibits or his tables or anything on his forecasted demand. Am I to understand that?
That is correct.
Okay. Well, then I'm just going to lay out some ground rules, and I'm going to represent to you what he's got in his testimony, and we'll figure it out with him and get it all in the record So kind of assume these as hypotheticals, all right? If you have in your demand the requirements of a DS3, how many? What's the equivalent? How much capacity is that?
A DS3 is equivalent to 28 DS1 circuits.
So how many DS1s in an OC3?
An OC3 is equivalent to 3 DS3s, which therefore would be equivalent to 84 DS1s.
All right, so if the most demand ever forecasted for our system for all traffic is only 64 DS1s, a DS3 is sufficient to carry all that traffic, correct?
No.
Why is that?
Because a DS3 is only 28 DS1s.
I'm sorry, an OC3. But an OC3 would be sufficient for 64 DS1s.
If we had 64 DS1s in the network and that was all we were transporting, then an OC3 with 84 DS1 capacity would be sufficient.
Okay. That's Ms. Wiest, I'm going to mark these exhibits. They contain confidential information, but I think I can ask questions in a way that the questions won't be confidential. This is exhibit 14 also. Or excuse me, exhibit 13. Do all of these at the same time. So I don't have to walk up here. Yeah, you can do one first.
You are listening to South Dakota Public Broadcasting's coverage of the 84th Legislative Session.
It's back on.
Yeah, I'm sorry. And I'm going to take these exhibits in order. And first of all, you work with this equipment every day, and if you need to, I've got a copy of the FLEC useful life capital investments table here if you have questions on these useful life. But do you agree that fiber cable investment useful life runs about 20 years? I can show you what was used in the FLEC study.
Mr. Wizard, for clarification, are you referring to one of Mr. Eklund's tables that was included in his testimony, or is this something different?
I'm referring to,
it's all the same document. I'm just going to try to avoid marking it. I'm referring to FLEC telephone run 20 input data. I'm assuming that you gave Mr. Eklund kind of useful life information on this equipment, or do you disagree with the FLEC input as to useful life?
Which question would you like me to answer first?
Well, I want you to answer the first one first, and I might get rid of the second one.
You know, with regards to this document you've handed me, it lists the useful or the life for buried cable at 20 years.
Okay. You don't speak to use because let me ask you then. Did you give Eklund useful life of the equipment?
Could you sit down and speak into the microphone?
Did you give Eklund the useful life of the equipment that you are suggesting that they install?
I did not provide the information that is listed in here.
Okay. The do you agree with those years as that's the useful life, or is that something that you have never dealt with?
Yeah, you know, I'm not an accountant. I don't, you know, understand what they typically utilize for a depreciation period for fiber optic cable.
Okay. So is your testimony that the useful life, actual useful life, is longer or shorter than that?
I guess, you know, I'm not testifying either way on that. This is, you know, certainly something that falls into Mr. Eklund's area of expertise. That, you know, what is the depreciable life of the investment? And he indicated 20 years, or at least if this is his document, it indicates 20 years on this.
All right. Then I tell you what, if these are his documents and his information, I'll talk to Mr. Eklund about that. I apologize. I thought you had provided some of this information. So let's just go back then to some general hypotheticals. If all the future demand that's estimated is 180 DS1s, could that be serviced with an OC12 system?
And OC12 has sufficient capacity to carry 180 DS1s.
Okay. And OC12 would have capacity to carry, let's see if I understand this right. To get the capacity of an OC12, you take 12 times 28, and that gives you the amount of capacity of the DS1 level. Is that correct?
Correct.
And I just did the math here on my calculator rather than longhand, and I get 336 DS1. Is that correct?
According to my computations, that is correct.
All right. So, and an OC48 then has, under the same calculations, you take 48 times 28. Am I correct there?
That is correct.
And that's, I get 1,344 DS1s. Is that correct?
1,344 DS1s is the ultimate capacity of an OC48. Right.
And so about 1,000 more DS1s.
Approximately.
I want to talk about the switching costs for a bit. You talked a little bit about special circuits in your testimony and then today. Special circuits are not switched. They don't go, is that correct?
It depends on what type of special circuit it is, but typically special circuits, do not interface to the switch.
When I think of special circuits, and I'm sure there's, I think of things like private lines or dedicated business lines where they're exchanging data and things like that. I don't think of common voice traffic. Do people use special circuits? Do these companies use special circuits to exchange common voice traffic?
I can't speak to, what the customers of these companies use their special circuits for.
Okay, you talked about the so you can't speak to what these companies use special circuits for. You gave a diagram that you talked about at length in your testimony, on page 3, which is the unconfidential page, you talked about possible sequence of events that would require voice traffic to go through this multiplexing. Can you tell the commission whether that occurs for any of these four companies?
As far as whether they require this external multiplexing equipment for their...
No, I'm asking whether that event where somebody's bringing in a DS1 that they have to go through this channel banking to drop off voice trunks to get them to the switch, I'm asking whether you know if that occurs for any of these companies.
If there's specific circuits that have both switch traffic and special traffic on it?
Yes.
That's typical of any company.
Well... are you saying that that occurs as a regular basis? That's the unusual occurrence, wouldn't you agree?
It occurs in these networks. I wouldn't say it's unusual for a company to have, a DS1 coming in from an outside entity that has a combination of voice circuits and special circuits on it.
Well, it's always been my understanding that the RLX don't allow multi-jurisdictional traffic to come over special circuits. Is that wrong?
I guess I can't speak to what they allow or don't allow on those special circuits.
All right. So are you aware of the existence of this channel banking special circuits for any of these companies currently that it occurs?
I can tell you that whether it be a channel bank or a DAX, these companies have those types of devices in place today, yes.
Yeah, but that's not what I'm asking. I'm asking on this special circuits. Can you testify whether that is occurring for any of these companies today, your diagram that you put in the evidence?
Like I said, it's a common occurrence that all these companies, that companies typically have.
So are you aware of any? You're speculating.
I can't speak to a specific circuit ID number that has got a mixture of traffic that's more granular than.
Well, this would only be for traffic they'd be receiving from somebody else. As I understand your testimony, the way you calculated common trunk usage, that you calculated by figuring out how many DS1s would be necessary to deal with the voice trunks in the company, correct? in your network, you figured out how many voice trunks. You divided that by 24 to come up with a number of DS1s for common voice traffic.
For the FLEC model, correct.
Right. So in the FLEC model contains none of these examples.
In the FLEC model, we didn't assume any interfaces in the switch that had special circuits on them because they don't exist.
Okay. So in your efficiently designed network, all voice traffic that you're assuming is on the DS1 level.
Coming into the switch, it would be on the DS1 level.
The So
if I may clarify that, it would be on a DS1 or a DS3 level, depending on the location.
All right, thank you. So we talked earlier about voice traffic for at least a couple of these companies. And I'm going to talk generally if Ms. Moore has an issue, so I'm not tying it back to a company, that switch voice traffic could be handled by an OC3. My understanding, you've testified that you believe all these companies will exceed capacity of an OC48 sometime during the life of this equipment, correct?
I would expect it when you look at the holistic requirements for transport over the next 10 years that an OC48 would likely not be sufficient.
Okay. And that's not, and we've determined that's not coming from switch voice traffic. That's all these other services that we talk generally about, correct?
Transport is required for a multitude of services.
Right. Well, what's driving that capacity demand is other services besides switched voice traffic. You'd agree with me?
It's all services that go on this network. You know, you can.
Yeah, my question isn't that hard. If all I need to do with switch voice traffic is an OC3, what drives the demand for you to recommend to this commission that it adopt an OC192 is the other services.
I'm going to object to this question as a hypothetical. I'm not sure if we're referring to a specific company or a general scenario, and I think it's going to confuse the issues.
Overrule.
For those companies in which an OC3 would be sufficient for their switch to access services, you know, the drivers that would push them to an OC192 would likely come from those other services,
okay.
Those multimedia services.
The DSL, the video, the TV.
Various multimedia services.
Okay. And petitioners have deployed DSL technology on this network.
On their network or on this FLEC network?
Well, you're figuring the DSL network information will be on this network. Is that correct?
Yeah, my understanding is all four of these companies offer DSL services today.
Okay. And the transport for the DSL, do you know whether that was included as part of Mr. Eklund's demand?
I can't speak to his demand projections. That would be a question for Mr. Eklund.
Okay, I'm asking you, want you on the discovery in front of you, turn to question 21. You can read the question and read the response to yourself. So the transport for DSL, at least according to the answer to this question, was included as part of the DS1 demand. Do you see that?
I see that.
So if the total demand is only that's been projected is only 300 DS1s, and that includes the DSL, that would be sufficiently carried by an OC12, wouldn't it?
Can you restate the question, please?
Well, if the DSL demand's been included in the forward-looking demand, and I'm just going to give you a generic number rather than go on and off the record. I think everybody can do the math as long as we have these principles down. But if it's only 300 DS1s is all the demand that's being shown and DSLs incorporated in it, an OC and the 300 DS1s is all demand, meaning everything, that can be handled by an OC12, correct?
As we've stated, you know, an OC12 is a capacity of 336 DS1 or equivalents, and 300 DS1s is obviously less than that.
Okay. So, staying with the discovery, are you familiar that the petitioners have all deployed video or cable TV capacity on their network?
I know that several of them have video services.
And did you, when you came up with the size of the network, the OC192, envision video or cable using your projected network?
I assumed that multimedia services would be used on the network.
So I'm going to ask you to turn to question 27 on that discovery, where it asks them to admit that petitioner video or cable TV services utilize petitioner's fiber optic transport network as set forth in petitioner's cost model. So the and Kennebec, what did Kennebec respond?
The response to question 27 for Kennebec says denied video traffic is carried on separate fiber that was not included in Kennebec's revised flex study.
But when you did this efficient network, you thought there would be video traffic on this efficient network?
As part of other multimedia services, yes.
Okay, but Kennebec actually used not including that in this. I mean, I guess I'm troubled. The fact you're using the video as justification for building this humongous network, but Kennebec's using some other network to carry that at this point, and didn't he?
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I didn't allow you to finish your question,
right,
and then I'll interpose my objection.
But I just gave me a chance to re-ask it. So, I'll just ask it this way. You, when you designed the network, considered that it would carry video, except video has not been included in the Flex study according to this.
Objection. First of all, foundation, because you haven't asked this witness if he assisted in drafting these particular responses, so therefore you haven't established his basis or knowledge for responding to the particular question. And the second basis is it's argumentative.
Can you ask any questions on foundation for this?
Well, and I guess I can ask him whether, did you help prepare the response to this question?
I did not.
All right. Well, assuming that it's true that video traffic is carried on a separate fiber and was not included in the Kennebec's revised Flex study, does that surprise you given the way you designed this network?
With respect to that, I'll overrule your objection.
For Kennebec specifically? I want to make sure I understand the question correctly. Can you restate it, please?
Well, and I'll go right back through it. You assumed video was going to go on your study. I mean, that's how you did your proposed network. However, if you assume that's true, that video traffic is carried on a separate fiber and was not included in Kennebec's revised Flex study, you'd agree that that's not going to go on your proposed plan, though.
When I look at this, particular response Flex study seems to be a very broad categorization. When they say it's on a separate fiber, you know, and I can't speak to what Mr. Eklund did, but when it's on a separate fiber, my assumption of that would be that that would be part of the separations process, that that fiber was removed from the cost. So therefore, the video has been accounted for. But like I said, I don't have firsthand knowledge of what Mr. Eklund did.
And so, if video service transport capacity was not to be included as part of the projected demand on a network, would that impact the size of the network?
If video service is not placed on this network, it has the potential of impacting the size of the network.
Okay. And you talked a little bit about costing and paying for these networks. If video services are going to be provided on a network, you would agree with me that that demand should be considered in figuring out everybody's cost to pay for that network?
You know, certainly the scope of my testimony surrounding the cost inputs, the engineering design, I can only speculate on, you know, how cost separations are done, so I'm probably not the appropriate person to ask that question on.
You're not sitting here advocating to the commission that they should let some demand ride for free on this network, are you?
I'm not advocating that.
Okay. So if video services are using this transport network, they should carry some of the cost.
And I believe that, you know, Mr. Eklund has his responsibility in this is to separate the cost, to allocate the usage of the network to the user of the network.
Okay. Yeah. You advise these companies, you work with these companies, you're the head of engineering at Vantage Point, correct?
I'm the director of engineering at Vantage Point, correct.
So you wouldn't advise some company to let video or cable TV ride for free over their network, would you?
I guess when it comes to the accounting side, I can't speak to that.
You talked a little bit about the transport outside plant costs. And that you thought, when you did your estimate, you only, as to what, if you reduced the fibers from 48 to 24, that only save a couple percentage points, but that was only based on in-town costs, correct?
The basis of that was we referred back to the town construction cost to base that off of because we had the largest volume of units for it. But when it comes to the fiber optic cable material, you know, the material is the material, whether it be placed in town or in the rural.
Right. Yeah, but the cost of placing in rural is much cheaper.
For the labor.
Right. Well, and that's the biggest portion of it. But the, so you don't, you're not, I just want to be clear, when Conwell came back and said, well, you know, if you actually include where you place all fiber, it drops between 7% and 9% as opposed to 1.25%. You don't dispute his calculations and his testimony. You, as I understand your testimony earlier, you just think that's a de minimis amount.
You know, as I indicated in my testimony earlier, I referred to his exhibit and, referred to his calculations. They, you know, while I haven't, you know, physically run the calculations myself, they appear to be ballpark. I feel it's de minimis just due to the fact that, you know, when you're talking about a 7% difference, you know, that could be made up in just the inflation costs of placing the fiber from one year to the next.
You talked about the switching, and it's my understanding, I just want to make sure I got your testimony correct this morning when Ms. Moore is asking you questions, is that this is probably the easiest way to ask it. You removed those four or five items. Had you removed them before the hearing last summer, your numbers would have been the same as they are today, correct?
It would have been no different. These were the items that were inputted into the original FLEC model, and all we merely did was remove those items.
Okay. Did you look the fact that Eklund's projecting minutes of use to fall by somewhere between, for these companies, I'll just give a range, between 20 and 35%, depending on the company.
Yes, I have no specific reference to the minute views projections.
Okay, so, well, did you make any adjustments for the drop in the minutes of use to these costs?
Objection. We've already decided the issue with regard to usage sensitivity in the Commission's findings of fact and conclusions of Law 16 and 17, and therefore it's not appropriate to change the standards at this time.
Overruled.
Can you repeat the question, please?
I don't want to draw another objection, so if I could just have her read it back, and then we know the exact question that's been permitted.
Question. So did you make any adjustments for the drop in the limits of use to these costs?
No, the switch investment was not adjusted. If I could clarify that, and the reason for that is because when you look at the switch itself, the switch was designed off of usage-sensitive basis of the number of concurrent call attempts it could handle, not necessarily minutes of use. So while minutes of use may decline, that's not indicative of the requirements for concurrent call attempts.
The Ms. Weiss, if I could request just a short recess to go through. I want to go through my questions. I had a line of questions on these exhibits thinking that he had provided some of the information, and I want to make sure that I didn't jump over something else that I need to ask him, since I'm going to now ask, I kind of move that line of questioning off to Eklund, given how this was going.
This would be a good time to take a 10-minute break anyway for the court reporter. So we'll be on recess for 10 minutes.
Thank you.
We're back on the web, and you may begin again, Mr. Bizarre.
A couple of questions, Mr. Weber. The I just want to make sure I've got this clear. On the sample exhibit that you did on page 3 of your final testimony, today you can't tell me how often that occurs, and you don't know whether it ever occurs for either of these four companies, do you?
With regards to that document, really the purpose of that exhibit was to provide some illustrative purposes stating that this exists for companies. I can't speak specifically to how frequently it exists for either of these four companies. However, it's meant to show that it does exist and that external circuit conditioning equipment is required for not only the special circuit equipment, but also the voice services.
Okay.
And Mr. Conwell's conclusion, that arbitrary conclusion without any supporting fact, that a DS0 special circuit costs more than a voice circuit is unfounded. It's just meant for illustrative purposes.
Okay, so in other words, you don't have any quantitative proof as to whether even any of these companies have it. You just say this just occurs in the industry.
It occurs.
Demand that I'm trying to do this out, getting back onto confidential. I'm sorry. Well, I'll just do it as a hypothetical. If a company is going to have demand that exceeds an OC 48. You'd agree with me that the cost providing that capacity should be spread across that demand.
You know, while I'm not the individual who conducts the actual accounting of this, my understanding is that the purpose of the flex study is to divide the cost of the network amongst the users of the network.
Right. And if you've testified today, you believe that future demand for that network will exceed an OC48. So therefore, you would agree with me that that demand, all that demand, shall pay for that cost of your proposed OC192 network.
I guess my conclusion would be that the users of the network should pay based on their usage of the network.
All right. Thank you. That's all.
Ms. Kramer.
Mr. Weber, when your attorney was directing, you had stated that the reason for the OC-192 is that it's necessary if the bandwidth has ever exceeds the OC-48 system. Do you remember? And I'm paraphrasing here, but...
Yes.
So what happens if it is exceeded one time? Or, I mean, what happens?
Well, the problem is that, you know, an OC-48 has a finite limited amount of traffic it can carry. If for some reason the traffic demand, you know, rises above the capacity of an OC48 by even a DS0, then you need to increase the size of the network to an OC192 to support it. I mean, any time that spikes above an OC48, it means the OC48 physically can't carry that traffic.
But what happens to the traffic? Is it carried 10 seconds later?
It would never be put on the network because there's just physically no way to interface into the network.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioners?
Thanks, Ms. Weiss. Mr. Weber, at some point in response to a question by Mr. Wazorek, I think you said that if an OC3 is sufficient to carry all traffic, that an OC-192 may not be warranted. And I'm focusing on that may not be warranted. Would there be any situation under which an OC-3 is sufficient to carry all traffic, but an OC-92 would be warranted?
You know, there are situations where, you know, some of the services that may be provided over different infrastructure today would eventually be migrated into the transport network. Under those situations, while... You know, it's, you know, my understanding is, you know, I believe Mr. Wazorek mentioned video traffic, you know, riding on separate fibers at one point. You know, if that traffic is transitioned at some point in time for an upgraded service onto this transport network, then that would obviously warrant something beyond an OC3.
But those sort of migrations happen in a predictable way that's forecasted out a number of years, or those... generally have to do, are those more short-term decisions or decisions that are made closer to action time?
It really depends on the company. There's no one set answer that I can state. You know, some have a strategic, some companies, talking just very generically, some companies have a strategic vision of how they're migrating services. Some do it based on an immediate need.
Is the hypothetical situation that you and Mr. Wazorek discussed and that you and I are discussing, I mean, does that exist for any of the four companies specifically we're talking about?
As far as, you know, migrating certain traffic off of a separate fiber, you know, I believe, you know, I can't speak specifically to time frames, but I believe some of these companies may be planning transitioning a video service from one type of video to another, yes.
Thanks. That's all I have, Ms. Weiss. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Weber, you spoke of 24 and 48 fiber capacity. Do you know what the difference is? I think you said that 70% of laying the cable is labor, and then 35%, you divided up the other 30%. Do you have an idea of what the hard number is, apples to apples, cable to cable, from a 24 to a 48 is, disregarding the sheath and everything, if you were just to compare two like cables? And you don't have to be very specific. Is it tens of dollars, hundreds of dollars, thousands of dollars?
Specifically to the cable investment?
Yes.
You know, if you look at just on a per unit basis, as I provided in my testimony, you know, based off of the costs that we used to estimate the town construction, the difference between a 48 and a 24 fiber averaged out to be about 20 cents a foot.
20 cents a foot. Right. Okay. But that's including everything, correct?
That's
the sheath, the
exactly.
labor, everything like that.
Exactly.
So it's probably even less than that if you were just gonna change the type of cable.
Possibly.
Okay. And also, well, that's more of accounting questions, but thank you.
To piggyback on Commissioner Kolbeck's question, you had indicated, Mr. Weber, that the 20 cents was based on materials and labor, I thought.
Based on materials. The labor to put the cable in the ground is the cost to put the cable in the ground. I mean, physically, the size of a 24 fiber cable from an outer, you know, diameter perspective is really no different than a 48 fiber cable, and thus the labor to lay it in the ground is no different.
So the 20 cents per foot is just a material cost?
That's a material cost.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that matched up with your testimony. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Thank you. This is Greg Russell with the commission. In going through this, I have to admit I'm having a lot of trouble. When we've gone through arbitrations before, which we have, where we look at forward-looking demand, we're used to seeing a usage amount, and then we see a system designed to cover that usage over a forecasted period, and then costs are assigned to the different services. And I'm having one heck of a time doing that with your demand and your systems. They just don't seem to match up to me. And, you know, maybe this question would be better for your other witness, but frankly, I need some explanation why you would design a system and really not have a whole lot of input with regarding usage when you make that design. It just doesn't make sense to me, and I guess I need that explained.
When you look at these companies, as I've stated previously, and we're not taking, you know, into account something that is non-existent. This is what these companies have deployed today to handle their current services and what, you know, they're potentially proposing for the future. You know, as I indicated in response to Commissioner Johnson's question, you know, some of these companies are transitioning services from one form to another, which obviously would, you know, increase the demand of the Sonnet transport infrastructure.
And I understand that, but when we're talking about an arbitration, we're dealing with projections. And I understand you're designing systems, OC-192s, and that's fine, but this is all hypothetical where we're trying to match usage with a system and cost. And I'm not disagreeing that perhaps an OC-192 isn't necessary, but I think the counterpoint is you have to have usage statistics that back that up. And frankly, I don't see those.
And when it comes to the usage and the projected usage demand, that's something that Mr. Eklund has conducted.
I guess my question to you would be this then, but you didn't look at Mr. Eklund's usage before you designed your network?
When we had originally gone through this exercise, we designed the network. You know, the commission came out with their findings of facts and conclusion of law. You know, we provided information to Mr. Eklund as well as to Altel concerning some alternative size networks. And I believe Mr. Eklund has rerun the Flex study in some cases using OC-48.
With regard to the circuits coming into the central office, and I'll use DS1 because it just seems easier, but in going through the testimony and talking about the cost, is it typical that you'd have mixed traffic on all the DS-1s coming into the central office?
Not on all the DS-1s. You know, there's certain DS-1s that would have mixed traffic just because, you know, the provider who's, you know, sending you that traffic wants to maximize their transport efficiency and fully utilize the DS-1.
Would you have any estimate, let's say out of 24 coming in, which ones would be all voice switch traffic versus those that have intermixed traffic? Would you have any sense of that?
You know, I couldn't speak specifically to these four companies, but typically speaking, you know, most providers will tend to split up their traffic on, you know, special circuits like SS7A links and whatnot on separate DS1s. So,
sorry, I lost you. They would tend to split up their traffic,
you know, for special circuits, such as SS7A links and other services, onto a minimum of two different DS1s, just for practical purposes, in case a single DS1 went down, it wasn't catastrophic for the network.
So would you say 50-50?
You know, I wouldn't say necessarily 50-50 by any stretch of the imagination. When we talk about breaking it down to a DS0 level, you know, if in your example, I don't recall how many DS1s you'd...
Well, I just threw out, you know, whatever would work with the DS. I mean, just take any number would work, whether it's 20 or 30, and just, you know, some sense of what percentage would be all voice or switched, and what percentage would be those, you know, the special type services that, you know, talking about the multiplexing services you needed.
Right. And just generically, you know, I would expect that if we were assuming 20, that, you know, approximately 2 to 4 of those DS1s would be mixed traffic.
Okay. And all the others would be voice.
Right.
Okay. Which, and again, I can't point to anywhere in your specific testimony, but I'm just curious. You know, there was a lot of talk about costs, and I know the commission's done their work, but I'm just curious because there was so much give and take within the testimony, both the direct and the rebuttal. I'm curious what you see is the difference in cost between those voice only and those with intermixed traffic.
You know, considering the FLEC model where we have other traffic that uses external multiplexing equipment, you know, I wouldn't see, you know, a tremendous difference in the cost between the two.
Is that because you have to be able to look at intermixed traffic for each of those circuits ahead of time when you design your network, thinking that it could be more than 2 or 4 out of 20? It could be more than that?
It could be more than that. You know, the unfortunate thing that projections are very difficult to ascertain on what other providers are sending it to you and how they're packaged. You know, we just don't know how a Quest or an SDN Communications or, you know, pick another transport provider, how they're going to package their DS1s that they're ultimately terminating to you.
So it's kind of a guessing game in the future.
It can be, yes.
Okay, one more thing. And I heard you say that, and again, I find this a little confusing. Help me out if you can, but we were talking about, I think, fiber specifically, and talking about allocating costs of video away from the study. Is that correct? Was that what your answer was? That you'd specifically remove fibers related to video services?
You know, I guess my answer was that, you know, Mr. Eklund is the one who does the cost separations. You
so
know, I would have to rely on him to answer the question on if he removed those fibers associated with video service from the FLEC rate calculation.
So I have to save that question for Mr. Eklund.
Correct.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
If I might piggyback off Mr. Rizlov. Mr. Weber, you and Mr. Rizlov, I think, had an interesting exchange about the differences between designing a network for real life and designing it for the purposes of a FLEC study. In your experience in engineering systems for your clients, I mean, are there times when they'll go with an LC192, even if the projections don't quite say that they should, just because the incremental cost is minor, that they're willing to, in essence, pay an insurance policy that there won't be unpredictable growths in traffic of some kind between then and when the system would reach the end of its useful life?
And when you look at the companies that we do work with, you know, typically speaking, they will you know, look at the projected, you know, bandwidth demand. They'll come up with a best estimate on, you know, what the size of the network needs to be. Obviously, it's a crystal ball approach. But, you know, generally speaking, you know, companies, you know, realize based on their history that they put in an OC12 15 years ago and thought that was going to be enough and exceed that capacity. And they put an OC48 in and, you know, ultimately exceed the capacity. And the next step is OC192.
So because of their historical experience, they've gotten in the habit of investing in a system that at the time you're investing in it may seem too large. Is that accurate to say?
That would be accurate to say. You know, I've been designing these networks for 9.5 years. You know, since 2005, I would say probably 90 to 95% of the network elements I've put in have been OC192 or equivalent. And, you know, in these 9.5 years, I've never had a client come back to me and say that network was too large. On the contrary, I've had some that say we exhausted it before we ever thought we would.
Is that approach that is used in engineering a system in real life for your clients, is that also an appropriate way to view how one should engineer a system on paper?
When you look at engineering this thing on paper, it's about engineering a network that you would truly put in place, that you believe that is necessary for these companies. And when I put together the original FLEC engineering model, the reason why I used OC192 is because I fully believe that these companies need to have an OC192 for the next 7 to 10 years of the useful life of that equipment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Weber, when you talk about these companies, you do engineering with in all 50 states, or how many states?
You know, I don't have an exact count. I know it's north of 25 states.
Okay. Do the same principles apply in every state that you do business with? I mean, you don't necessarily design a South Dakota network and a Kansas network, and the amount of traffic and trends around the nation that you see, do they all remain consistent?
When you look at the rural service providers, you know, whether they be located in South Dakota or Indiana or, you know, pick a state, Montana, you know, the service demands that they have, the types of things that their customers are expecting are very comparable. So typically speaking, their needs are comparable, the network design is comparable, you know.
So would you say on a you install just as many OC192s in Montana as you do in South Dakota or Iowa or any other state?
You know, what's interesting is in Montana, I've actually probably put in more, you know, dense wavelength division multiplexing networks, which have more capacity than an OC192 than I have OC192s, and partially due to the fact that, you know, these companies had used RUS funding at a time when RUS limited them to only having 4 fiber cable. They're exhausted now. They've had to put other electronics on there to multiply the capacity of the fiber.
Okay. So I guess you don't see the network that we're discussing here at this hearing as any more elaborate than any other network you put in?
No.
In fact, it could be even less elaborate than some.
I've put in more capacity for other clients.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Mr. Weber, I think in response to a question from Mr. Rizlov, you mentioned that Mr. Eklund had rerun the FLEC studies using an OC48, but you're still recommending the use of an OC192, correct?
That's correct. Based on my engineering experience, based on what I've, you know, been responsible for the last 9.5 years, I fully believe that these companies will ultimately need an OC192 before the end of the useful life of the equipment.
So your recommendation isn't necessarily based on Mr. Eklund's forecasted demand?
No.
And I think as you just mentioned, your recommendation of OC192 was based over the life of the equipment. So you would it be correct to say that you would agree that any forecasted demand should be based over the life of the equipment to do a proper forecasted demand?
You know, I guess, you know, from a forecasting perspective, that's, you know, that's not my area of expertise. I would have to rely on someone else to make that assumption. You know, all I know is that when you look at the types of services that we're trying to look forward, you know, for our clients and what they need to offer, you know, it's difficult to project those out 7 to 10 years. I mean, there's applications they may be serving 7 to 10 years from now that haven't even been invented yet. So it's really a difficult task.
But your recommendation of OC-192 is based on your understanding of the life of the equipment used, isn't it?
Correct.
So when you were looking at what the demand would be for an OC-192, you used the life of the equipment to come up with your recommendation of an OC-192.
Correct. The intention was to have a system in place that was sufficient to handle the transport demands for the life of the equipment.
Okay, thank you. Any redirect?
Briefly, please. Mr. Wezorek talked with you about OC3s, and specifically, I think, two statements made for both Kennebec and McCook as to whether an OC3 would be sufficient to carry the voice traffic or the switch traffic for those particular companies. Do you commonly engineer transport systems using OC3, do you commonly engineer networks that use an OC3 transport system?
No, in the 9.5 years that I've been engineering these networks, I've never put in a system that had an OC3 as the SONET transport network backbone. We've had situations where an OC3 is a tributary interface off the main ring, but never the line rate for the ring.
In your opinion, as a professional engineer, is an OC3 transport system an efficient network for McCook?
No.
Is it an efficient network for Kennebec?
No.
Mr. Wezorek also talked with you about an OC12 transport system in the context of both Santel and West River. Do you commonly engineer networks using OC12 transport systems?
No, I do not.
Excuse me. In your opinion, do you believe an OC12 transport system is an efficient network for Santel?
No, I do not.
Is it an efficient network for West River?
No.
When you go to design a network and ultimately construct a network for a client, you consult with various vendors as to the types of equipment they offer, correct?
Correct.
Is it a commonly advertised transport system anymore? Is an OC3 and an OC12 something that is actively sold by vendors these days?
The equipment vendors do have OC3 and OC12 optics in their products. However, what they've done is they've packaged these, because they're primarily used for tributary interfaces, they package these in typically 4-port or 8-port or even greater increments. So you can't buy just one OC3 interface, you're buying 4 or 8. So that causes the cost of those cards to be greater than, you know, what a single port card used to be, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, and makes it so really the cost difference between an OC48 and an OC12 is very negligible.
And let's talk about the specific difference in component parts between an OC48 and an OC192. And forgive me if I use incorrect terms here, but what I mean by saying the component parts, I'm talking about the fiber optics, the tributary costs, the base costs. What's the same between an OC48 and an OC192 as far as those component parts?
When you look at the differences between an OC48 and an OC192, when you compare the similarities, you take a look at the fiber investment. That doesn't change if we go from an OC48 to an OC192. I mean, we need to have fiber for either network. So that investment remains constant. You look at the base cost of the chassis and the common cards and you know, power supplies and various other features like that. That does not change. Even the tributary interfaces, the DS1 interfaces, the DS3 interfaces that we're putting onto the transport network, those remain the same. The only thing that changes is the line optics themselves, the OC48 cards that plug into the shelf versus the OC192 cards that plug into the shelf. That's the only difference from a cost perspective.
In your professional experience, is it efficient to design a network, whether it's one on paper or whether it's one that will be ultimately implemented for a company? Is it efficient to design a network using a transport system that is smaller or has less capacity than what these four companies are using today?
I don't believe so.
Why not?
just due to the fact that, you know, these companies have put in the networks they have for a distinct reason, because, you know, they expect the demand for the services that they're going to offer to be sufficient to support an OSU 192 or equivalent.
And when you design a network, do you design one network for voice services and one network for special services?
No, just like the FLEC engineering model, when we're designing a new network, to, you know, it's meant to carry all traffic.
Thank you. Nothing further.
Any additional cross, Mr. Mazzori?
So I understand your testimony here, the last couple of questions, is the reason you think these smaller networks are inefficient is because these companies have already determined they're going to have more demand than that in the future.
As they look at the range of services that ultimately they need to provide, as they look at forecasts and trends in the industry, they've determined that, you know, putting in an OC-192 network, you know, is logical to conclude that they put that in there because they expect to need that within the 10-year useful life of that equipment.
Yeah, and so to need the OC-192 network in the 7 to 10-year life of the equipment, you expect them to exceed capacity for the OC-48.
That would be correct.
All right. That's all I'd have.
Ms. Kramer. Commissioners.
Yes, Mr. Weber, you stated that the optics cards were the only difference between an OC-48 and an OC-192.
Correct.
But once you have an extra added expense for the 144 more DS3s or the over 4,000 more DS1 cards?
No, you don't, because all we've equipped is a certain number of interfaces into the system. You know, so if we had a call for a certain number of DS1s or a certain number of DS3s to be transferred on the system, that's been equipped for tributary interfaces. Any additional capacity, obviously, would require additional tributary circuit card investment to be placed in that network.
So you're saying that if you had an OC-48, you can make a OC-192 have the capacity of around maybe a OC-50 or 55, depending on how many tributary cards you put in.
Correct. It's based on what is provisioned on the system, what you have for physical interfaces equipped in the system.
Okay. So when you initially install an OC-192, the optics cards, the laser cards, are the biggest expense, or the only different expense.
When you compare it versus an OC-48,
yes,
that would be the difference, is the difference in the cost between the OC-48 and the OC-192 optics, correct?
Okay. Just to be clear, when you install a 192, that's the extra expense. You don't necessarily have to have the total capacity of a 192 until it's needed.
Until it's needed, correct.
Okay.
So as additional services are required, we'd add additional
tributary
cards and add that cost at that point in time.
Okay. The tributary cards can be, the DS1s, DS3 cards can be added later.
Correct.
On different shelves. So.
Correct.
Thanks.
Any redirect, Ms. Moore?
No, thank you, Ms. Wiest.
Thank you, Mr. Weber.
Thank you.
It is 5 to 12, so I think it would be a good time to break for lunch. When would the commissioners like to come back?
Seems difficult to get it done in an hour sometimes. Council generally has things they want to try to get done, so I mean 1:15, 1:20, I don't know. I mean, as far as I'm out of time, an hour 15 or an hour 20?
Yep, 1:15, we'll be back. Thank you.